Have you and your parents discussed it?
Yes, sir.
And what was your parents' point of view when you told them or they suggested to you, I'm not sure how it went down, that you and the Army might be a good fit?
My mom just smiled and just said, I'm proud of you. And that was it.
And that was it?
Yes, sir.
Are you finding that young people like Javon primarily want to go, Commander, into the services, as he said, because of school, or is it also for financial reasons? Because we said at the top of the show that a number of people who are enlisting, from the reports we get, are doing so because the job market is so poor and this is a place to make a living.
I think a lot of it depends on the individual's needs and wants. For example, I had a applicant who wanted to do the reserve component, which in layman's terms means to be a part-time soldier. And meanwhile, he ended up getting his wife pregnant and decided, hey, you know, I don't want to do it part-time anymore. I want to see if I can go active. So in his particular case, he felt by him switching from reserve to active was something that he needed to do in his life because he was starting a new family.
Now, I asked Douglas a few moments ago whether or not people who were enlisted were re-upping, and you had a reaction to that here in the studio, which indicated to me that you think that that's true, that they are doing that.
Yes, actually recently, yesterday, I re-enlisted a soldier in my company, Staff Sergeant Campos, out at Santa Clarita. He's a volunteer baseball coach out there, and he just re-enlisted. 2 months ago, I had another soldier, Staff Sergeant Palmer, who he's from Thousand Oaks, and we re-enlisted him out by the Rose Bowl. I just got back from Iraq 7 months ago. My 15 months that I was in Iraq, I had eight soldiers work under me. Out of those eight soldiers, when their time came up for re-enlistment, all four of them I re-enlisted in Iraq.
Now, why did they re-enlist?
A lot of them re-enlisted based off of family situations, based off of a sense of job satisfaction and security.
Now, there have been some things written publicly about the benefits that people in the military get once they separate from the military. And even the President Obama has been talking about trying to do more for veterans, particularly those who go to Iraq. Has this been an issue when you talk to recruiters like Javon about what will be available to them once they come out of the service?
It has not been an issue, but I know from my experience with working with soldiers that do retire out, they're able to collect a pension as long as they serve 20 years in. And from my experience, a lot of soldiers that I have known at my previous unit have been able to retire at a young age because they went into the military and served their 20 years early and were able to collect retirement on top of starting a second job. I had a senior NCO tell me, why retire once if you could retire twice? Mm. And based off the economy, you know, that's probably a for sure way to go.
Javon, let me ask you a question.
Yes, sir.
If you did not go to the Army, what would you do with your life?
I would have gone to a community college, and then I would have transferred to a university of some sort.
And tell me again, so that I'm clear, what was it about the Army that made you feel that was the better way to go than to do what you just said you would do otherwise?
When she told me about the free, they would pay for college.
That's pretty much it?
Yes, sir.
And it was the Army always, as opposed to the Navy or Air Force or Marine Corps, for you?
Not really.
You didn't give that much thought?
No, sir.
Were anybody in your family opposed to the idea?
Not that I recall.
Not that you recall. Any of your friends doing this?
One of my friends, Marvin, he signed up Wednesday, or around Wednesday.
After you? Based on the fact that you did it, he did it?
Just a week ago when they came up to the LA High. I told him about it and he joined up.
Well, good luck, young man.
Thank you.
I hope that the Army gives you what you are expecting it to do. Commander, good luck to you as well. I've been speaking with Captain Yamin Norwood, who is an Army recruiting commander for the San Fernando Valley here in California, and Javon Page, a recent Army recruit. They joined us here in the studios of NPR West. This is News in Notes. I'm Tony Cox. Time now for our Africa update. This week, Islamist insurgents seized the seat of Somalia's parliament, plus Rwanda arrests a Congolese rebel leader and Zimbabwe's opposition party is critical of the latest power-sharing deal. With us, Bill Fletcher. He is a senior scholar with the Institute for Policy Studies and former president of Trans-Africa Forum. Hello, Bill.
Hey, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you very much. Let's start in the Horn of Africa, Bill, if we can, where a suicide car bomb killed more than a dozen people in Somalia's capital city of Mogadishu this weekend. And today, just today, a hardline Islamist group seized the seat of the Somali parliament. Now, Al-Shabaab is on Washington's terror group list, that is, and leaders say that it will establish Sharia law in the city. So what is happening in Somalia right now?
Well, the situation, you know, goes from bad to worse, and basically what has happened is that the Ethiopian invasion of Somalia that happened a couple of years ago, allegedly to squelch the Union of Islamic Courts, which was running the country, turned into the complete failure that most people predicted that it would. And what ended up happening instead was that there was a resistance movement or an insurgency that made it impossible for the Ethiopians to stay. The transitional national government of Somalia, which was being supported by the Ethiopians, never had a great deal of credibility and has basically just been unraveling. So now what we have is this ironic situation of the return of a faction from the Union of Islamic Courts. But it's a hard-aligned faction. And I guess the other thing I would just say is that even though Al-Shabaab is on the U.S. terrorist list, there's no clear evidence that this is a group that is tied to international terrorism, as opposed to being a domestic military organization in Somalia.
Let's talk about the humanitarian side of the crisis in Somalia, because there are reports of a hidden genocide there. Is that true? It's still going on?
The humanitarian situation in Somalia is horrible. It gets very little international attention. You've had a massive exodus of people from Mogadishu and from the country itself because there really is no rule of law in Somalia. And what has further compounded the problem is that the resistance to the Ethiopian invaders and the transitional national government itself split. So they've been fighting one another and have been carrying out incredible numbers of attacks on civilian personnel. So youth are attacked, women are attacked. If you happen to be in an area, it's open season. So it's the situation is absolutely horrible. And although the African Union has been attempting to work to resolve the situation, the difficulty is that there are an insufficient number of AU troops on the ground, and they have been so far unsuccessful in getting all the parties to sit down to consider an opportunity for the future. And I think part of that is that some of the Islamist factions think, why should they sit down? They're on the verge of winning.
Let's move on to another topic. Last week, Congo rebel leader Laurent Nkunda was captured in neighboring Rwanda by a joint Rwandan Congolese military force. My question is actually what his status is, because there are reports that he is not arrested but is being held, not in jail, but someplace presumably much nicer. What is his relationship with the Rwandan government, and are they going to send him back to the DRC?
Well, this is a really interesting mystery, and I'm hoping that somebody writes about it, because you couldn't come up with this, you know, the best fiction writer. Laurent Nkunda is the head of a Tutsi militia in the eastern part of the Democratic Republic of the Congo. He allied with the Rwandans, the Rwandan government, and basically took the position that his militia was protecting the ethnic Tutsis against attacks that they were suffering from ethnic Hutus who were living in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. And the Hutus are refugees from Rwanda who left after the genocide, which was carried out by Hutus against the Tutsis. And they've been living there in exile. So Nkunda basically took the position that he was a champion of the Tutsis. The problem is that his activities, particularly his most recent military activities, created complete chaos in the eastern part of the DRC. And there were many allegations against him regarding human rights abuses. Then in the middle of this, as you said, Rwanda announced that they had arrested him. And my guess is that what's happening is that Rwanda and the DRC have cut a deal that basically includes the cessation of Rwandan support for the Tutsi militias and the agreement for joint military operations against the Hutus. And that under those circumstances, the Rwandans will hold on to Nkunda at least as long as the deal lasts. That's my guess.
So does that mean then that Nkunda's rebel army is no longer? It's not clear whether those guys, what happened to them?
That's precisely right. It's very unclear what happened. What the press is indicating is that Rwanda and the DRC are engaging or have agreed to engage in joint military operations against the Hutus. That may mean that Nkunda's troops get brought into the picture to fight alongside, or it may be that they simply are demobilized. But at this point, no one is saying very clearly, and I think that that's purposeful. That is that no one's saying.
All right, briefly, let's go into Zimbabwe to talk about the latest there in terms of the crisis involving Robert Mugabe and his ZANU-PF party. What's the latest?
The latest is that there have been continued talks. The Southern African Development Community, which is a regional organization in Southern Africa, primarily for economic development, has been attempting to guarantee some sort of peaceful transfer. But Mugabe and his clique have been very, very resistant to any degree of compromise. And the SADC has been pushing for, you know, a peaceful transition, for the establishing of some sort of internationally supervised elections, things along those lines. But President Mugabe seems to continue to hold out. And my guess is that until and unless the countries that make up the Southern African Development Community say, we will no longer cooperate with President Mugabe in any way, until that happens, I think that Mugabe's clique is going to continue to play a game.
Well, it looks as if there's no telling how long that might continue. Bill Fletcher, thank you very much.
My pleasure as always.
Bill Fletcher is a senior scholar with the Institute for Policy Studies and the former president of Trans-Africa Forum. He is the co-author of Solidarity Divided, The Crisis in Organized Labor and a New Path Towards Social Justice. He joined us from our headquarters in Washington, D.C. Now to the East. Celebrated hip-hop artist and poet Kanan grew up in war-torn Somalia, but he's got more street cred than your average gangster rapper. He fired his first gun at 8, and at 11 he saw gunmen slaughter 3 of his friends. Eventually, Kanan fled Somalia, and now he is making music about his experience. His new CD, Troubadour, blends hip-hop vibes with African and rock rhythms. How did Mandela get the will to surpass the everyday when injustice had him caged and trapped in every way? How did Gandhi ever withstand the hunger strikes and all? Didn't do it to gain power or money, if I recall, it's the gift. I guess I'll pass it on. Mother thinks it'll lift the stress of Babylon. Mother knows. My mother, she suffered blows. I don't know how we survived such violent episodes. I was Kanan, welcome to News and Notes.
Thank you for having me.
How difficult was it to come up to become a musician and an artist growing up in Somalia during the very difficult days that you did while you were there?
You know, that was difficult for everyone. And so I kind of shared in the piece of the pie of all that is struggle that is coming from these kinds of political breakdowns when the center can't hold anymore. And so I'm just a part of that group of people, and eventually that's really what fueled my music. That kind of a curse ended up being a blessing to a degree.
Do you ever wonder why you, growing up in Mogadishu, a place you've already described as the meanest streets in the universe, why you turned the direction that you did? You're not out with the pirates out in the Gulf of Aden. Do you ever think about how you made the choice you made?
I got fortunate, you know, to be able to channel some of my own internal crises, you know, like the crisis of being faced with these immeasurable amounts of difficulties that the people I come from face, and then having absolutely no venue of expression for it and no one to listen is really kind of a hard thing to kind of survive. And so I was really just fortunate to have found melodies and poetry and music, which has let me release that kind of, you know, problem externally.
On your new CD, Troubadour, there are a number of very interesting songs on there. One of them is I Come Prepared.
I made the list this year. I'm on a roll. You ain't no East Africa rock and roll. You won't know what time it is, like your clock is old. You ain't know we all packing like the block is sold. How could he be from the deepest, darkest of zero to become king of New York like De Niro? And he ain't even from New York, that's what's weird, yo. But where he's from, they just ret-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta. So come now, don't you try to play the hero.
The idea of the song is we are survivors, and so we come from this, and to have emerged on the other side is really something that takes courage, and it takes fortune and humor and all of it mixed up. And so what I'm saying is I come prepared is kind of saying, well, hey, you know, I couldn't have been any other way.
You know, you have another song on here. It's the first cut. It's called ABCs, and
yeah,
it reminds me of a really a profound combination of message, of music, of beat and lyrics, and it seems to be sort of along the lines of what you're talking about with I Come Prepared, isn't it?
Yeah, ABCs is just kind of like one of those moments, you know, where I'm using like a children's choir to tell my story. I have so many different influences and inspirations, and I feel like there's never a reason to disguise those influences. I think ABC is just like a classic Kanan song in the sense that it gives you the conflict of should I dance or should I think, you know?
Does suffering make for more realistic rap lyrics and provide more credibility the more you suffer?
Well, I think those who do not seek credibility tend to usually have credibility. I think that struggle does fuel good perspective.
Well, you know, I ask that because I wonder, I've heard comments that you've made to some extent denigrating certain parts of American hip-hop culture and music, and wondering if you think that it's necessary or if it's because of your experiences in Somalia that what you say has greater weight than someone who's rapping in America about something of lesser consequence.
Well, the truth is that I do respect people's struggles. You know, my gunshot wound is the same to you as the headache that you have. Everyone is entitled to voicing a struggle. What I was commenting on some of my songs and some of, you know, what you might have heard on the interview is really just about the glorification, the Hollywood version of violence that is in the genre that sometimes people put me in that I'm sometimes a part of. But just because we come from the real ugly version of violence, it's hard for me to respect it when it's the picture-perfect type of violence that is in hip-hop.
Let me ask you about your personal life a little bit. You and your mother escaped from Somalia in 1991, and what I understand is a pretty amazing story. You were in the States for a while. You now live in Toronto. The difficulties in Somalia continue. They're on the news every day. Are you torn about where you should and want to be with your life with regard to where you were born and where you are and what you are doing now?
Yes, sometimes I am. There is no true consolation for those sort of things. When you're on the phone with your cousins who are your age and aunties and so on, and they don't have the natural right of a human being. None of them have plans for the next day. They can't really. You just might be killed. And so when I'm hearing these things on a day-to-day basis, it's hard for me to sometimes, you know, I feel like I can never really do enough. And that's part of what my music comes from, kind of this survival guilt, you know.
I asked my students if they had a question for you after listening to your CD. And here's one from Juliana Silverstein. She says, what is your inspiration?
My inspiration is the continuous things that happen in the world, which either surprise us in grace or surprise us in the way that they seek destruction. These sort of extremities are truly what inspires me. Nothing in the middle ever inspires me. No mediocrity. If it's bad, it's the worst, which inspires me. And if it's great, it's the greatest. But I do it my own way, I do it my own way, I do. If you do what you do your own way, you could be famous too. If the beat is hot, does it matter where I'm from?
Kenan, it's a pleasure having talked with you, and I hope to get to meet you at some point. Good luck with the CD.
Thank you so much. I really, truly appreciate that.
Somali hip-hop artist and poet Kenan. His latest CD is Troubadour. He joined us from our studios in New York. From the west side of the Chi-town, like Twister, with a flow so sick it'll blow you to bits. It'll show you the glitz and the gold and the wrist and the boats and the fish. When I blow them a kiss, look bloke, you must be talking a piss or taking a piss. Are you talking a fish or the girls in the boat exposing it? I could have been from NY. I'm Tony Cox, and this is News and Notes. President Barack Obama broke through major racial barriers when he won the White House in November. But how does his achievement affect how different races feel about each other and what will change? At News and Notes, we've often discussed this issue from an African-American perspective, but rarely do we hear from folks who are not black on the sensitive subject of race, until today. We have invited bloggers who are white to join us and to hear from them their perspectives on race and the election of the nation's first black president. With us today are Dan Agin, an emeritus biologist at the University of Chicago and a blogger at the Huffington Post, and Brandon Perkins, a writer for LA Weekly and also a blogger for the Washington Post. Gentlemen, welcome to News and Notes.
Thanks, Tony.
Nice to have you. President Obama addressed our nation's history of racial division during his inaugural address last week. Here's part of what he said.
For we know that our patchwork heritage is a strength, not a weakness. We are a nation of Christians and Muslims, Jews and Hindus, and non-believers. We are shaped by every language and culture, drawn from every end of this earth. And because we have tasted the bitter swill of civil war and segregation and emerged from that dark chapter stronger and more united, we cannot help but believe that the old hatreds shall someday pass.
So, Brandon, how would you describe our nation's dialogue about race before Obama ran for the presidency compared to now?
Well, I think that, you know, throughout the years, race has always been difficult, especially for white journalists to address. You know, as things got more and more PC throughout the 90s, people were concerned about being lambasted for their views or for saying the wrong word or for their opinions being misconstrued somehow. And I think that things are getting even more sensitive now that Obama has taken office. But because he has obviously ascended to the most visible position in the world, it is a topic that is completely unavoidable now, and people are forced to deal with it.
That's interesting. Brandon says it's more sensitive and yet unavoidable. Dan, what do you say?
Well, I think, first of all, we have to recognize that this is a very pluralistic society. There's no one culture. There's no one group, and the various subcultures and groups in the society are going to react differently to what has happened. The election of Obama is a conceptual and intellectual and emotional watershed. There's no question about that. And the problem is that it's going to take time before the consequences ripple through the rest of the population. This is not something that's going to happen overnight. I don't think that the racial attitudes of the country, which are practically intrinsic to American society because they go back so many centuries, are going to disappear very fast. I don't think that at all. What I do think is that the presence of a black family in the White House is going to change the psychology for black children in an enormous way, and that will have a tremendous effect. But as far as the white population is concerned, there are segments of the white population that will be drawn to more interaction with people of color, but there are segments that won't. I don't think we can make a generalization about everybody.
Let me combine two questions in one for you, Brandon, and they're these. Is there a fear in the white community that President Obama's administration is going to somehow cater to minority interests at the expense of whites? And secondly to that, what is it that whites want from this new administration?
Well, to answer your first part, I mean, there's always going to be a segment of the population that's deranged and racially sensitive and conspiracy theory orientated. We can see that even in this first week with the little hullabaloo about Robert Reich saying that he, you know, wanted to make sure that some of these government jobs didn't go only to white construction workers. And, of course, the extreme right taking his words completely out of context and saying that, you know, he only wanted people of color in those jobs, unskilled or not.
The former labor secretary.
Correct.
Yes.
Correct. And to answer your second part of the question, I think that, you know, the majority of this country, you know, we want the change, and, you know, we've lost 200,000 jobs in the month of January already, and, you know, people are feeling that effect very much.
So do whites and blacks want the same thing, do you think?
I think so. I think, you know, amazingly as it is, that it's more than just the melanin in the skin that we want.
Do you agree with that, Dan?
Well, look, Barack Obama is an extremely competent guy, and the hope of everyone who feels threatened by the forecasts about the economy is that he can himself and the people around him find a fix so that we all don't go down the tubes. But that question is different than the question of the impact of his presidency on race relations. That's a different ballgame altogether. Everyone hopes that the federal government, now headed by Barack Obama, is going to save us from economic disaster. But at the same time as they hope that, there are many, many, many people who will not change their attitude overnight about people who are not white. It's not going to happen overnight. That's my take on it. It's an individual take, and like most things that have to do with society, we don't have any evidence to make an overwhelming demonstration that is the truth. But that's my personal take on this.
Here is an example of a difference of opinion, a quantifiable difference of opinion between blacks and whites as it relates to the president. A CNN poll showed that 53% of blacks say the American public will hold Obama to a higher standard because he is black. 61% of whites say Obama's race will not matter in how he'll be judged. Do you think, Brandon, that Obama will be held to a different standard because of his race?
I think that the power of his celebrity at this point has already put so much pressure and eyeballs on his everyday moves. You know, the photos from inside the White House are on PerezHilton.com, and you know, the school lunches of his children are being reported. And so much of what we've heard over the past 8 years has only been negative. We only heard about George Bush's family when the twins were getting in trouble for drunk driving or something like that. And it really goes back to the tone that he is putting. He's not going to be able to solve everything on his own, but it's the tone that he's putting out into the world that's really kind of filtering out into the rest. There's more of a positive tone there.
So, Dan, why do you think black and white Americans seem to view this issue so differently?
Well, first of all, if you're talking about white Americans, let's differentiate between the people who voted for Obama and the people who didn't vote for Obama.
Good
I think
point.
The people who did not vote for Obama are going to pick every possible fault that they can find in the politics and in the day-to-day life of Michelle and the kids. I mean, that's what they're going to do, because they would like to rip him out of the White House and put someone in there that they approve of politically. So again, it's not a homogeneous population. If you talk about white people, there are white people who voted for Obama, and there are white people who didn't vote for Obama, and their attitude about how he does day by day is going to be totally different, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, you sound. This is the way black people say it all the time. We're not homogeneous, and people don't seem to understand that.
Mm-hmm.
Let me let the listeners know what we're doing. You're listening to NPR's News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. If you're just tuning in, we're talking about race relations, and we do that all the time here at News and Notes, but we don't often do it with bloggers who are white. Today, we are. Dan Agin is an emeritus biologist at the University of Chicago and a blogger at the Huffington Post, and Brandon Perkins is a writer for the LA Weekly and also a blogger for the Huffington Post. Here's something, gentlemen, that came up that I'd like to get you to respond to. Several comedians, including Bill Maher, have talked about the difficulty they have making jokes about Barack Obama. And I hearken back to the Barack the Magic Dragon video parody that was done by a congressman that got him in such hot water. And we had when we played that on the station here, we had responses from the audience, people suggesting that maybe we need to lighten up, and when will it be okay to make Barack Obama the subject of parody. So my question, Brandon, is why do you think comedians, and others for that matter, feel uncomfortable making fun of Obama, especially whites?
Well, there's been a history of racial insensitivity in comedy over decades, and it's definitely mirrored the attitudes of race in America as a whole. And now that we were coming to this climax of sorts, where race is thrust so violent, not violently, but thrust so vividly into the American forefront, that they are going to be forced to deal with it. And the question comes, well, where did the jokes come from? The jokes have been very easy for the past 8 years, whether they were just simple bumbling sound clips or Bush walking into the wrong door that was locked, you know. And now we're faced with real issues and real problems, and somebody who handles himself very calmly and coolly. And it's an easy joke to make race, but it's one. It would be an easy joke to make one about race, but one that would not be accepted widely, I think, and you know, would put somebody out of a career, perhaps.
Is there a hesitancy, do you think, Dan, in terms of the kinds of remarks people can make, whether on stage or in private, about Barack Obama if the person making the remarks is white?
It depends on the audience. Absolutely depends on the audience. There are enclaves of white people who are essentially colorblind, and for these people, they can make jokes about Obama without feeling self-conscious about it, because they're not making jokes about his race that involve his race. In other collections of people, if they make jokes about Obama, race will always be a factor. As far as the people on stage are concerned, people on stage have an audience, and they're usually earning a living by saying certain things to that audience, and that's going to play a very important role in what they say and what they don't say. So again, homogeneity is a very difficult assumption to hold, because we're too pluralistic, and I don't think we can answer the question for everyone. We really can't, because the society is too fragmented in the way it thinks, in its history and its education and the kinds of work that people do.
I appreciate both of you coming on. My next question is this, though. Do you feel comfortable? And I've been watching your body language, Brandon, as we're sitting here, and I'm sensing that you're a little defensive because you're not mm-hmm. sure what I'm going to hit you with.
Well, sure.
That's fair, right?
I think a lot of it is, as I sit here, I feel almost more a member of the hip-hop generation than I do a white blogger. I would identify myself first with that. That's primarily the music that I cover.
Mm-hmm.
That is my area of expertise. And I think that Obama relates very much with this hip-hop generation, more than just having Jay-Z on his iPod. It's the way that he carries himself. Hip-hop has had this obsession with the word swagger for so much in 2008 that you could compile an entire album worth of songs just talking about boycotting the word swagger. And this is something that Obama carries himself with immensely and relates himself to. And in this hip-hop generation, since Dr. Dre exploded onto the scene with Nothing But a G Thing in the early 90s, the majority of the buying audience has been white. And there has been a mixing of the cultures. And I think that it's definitely affected Obama's ability to be elected in this country. Obviously, the support of the hip-hop community, both white and black, was immense in his campaign.
Certainly, there's a generational factor. Well, let me ask you, Dan, because as an emeritus biologist, you're closer in age to me than both of us are to Brandon. Do you feel comfortable being really honest? And I'm not suggesting that you are not being that now, but do you feel comfortable being honest about talking about racial issues when people of different races are around you?
Well, I'm a scientist, so you know, it doesn't mean anything to me. I feel no emotional pressure at all. Absolutely none. I feel no discomfort at all talking about these issues.
That's interesting. You don't feel that either, Brandon?
No. I mean, it's a fact of life. You know, the history of race in this country is well documented. And there are those differences, but, you know, as Dan has been saying, it's an incredibly fragmented and pluralistic society, and, you know, I can't sit here and speak for every single person who is white.
But when you got the call to come on a black show on National Public Radio to talk race, to talk about the president, the new black president, with a black host, did you not have pause?
No, I had no, I mean, I've spent my entire career reporting on black artists and dealing with something that's pretty much called black music, despite whoever is buying it or running the record labels. And a lot of that has to deal with race. You know, how am I going to quote an artist who is using the N-word? Am I going to spell that out? Am I going to stay true to the quotes? You know, a lot of that comes down to the publication, of course. But, you know, these are questions that I've asked myself throughout my entire career.
Final thing is this. We have less than a minute. Dan, are you feeling hopeful about race relations in this country now? More hopeful than perhaps you were before this election?
I think it's going to take time. It's going to take a long time because I may be a pessimist, but I'm fully cognizant of the history of the country and the degree to which racism, not only against blacks but against anybody who's different than people in Wichita, Kansas, is a part of the fabric of American society, and it's not going to be overturned very, very quickly. I don't think so.
A yes or no from you, Brandon. Are you feeling more hopeful?
Yeah, I think I am feeling more hopeful. A lot of it comes down to the tone of unity coming from the president's office right now.
Gentlemen, I can't thank you enough for coming on. We'd like to invite you back sometime.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you.
Dan Agin, an emeritus biologist at the University of Chicago and a blogger at the Huffington Post, joining us from the studios of WBEZ in Chicago. And Brandon Perkins, a writer for the LA Weekly and also a blogger for the Huffington Post, joining me right here in the studios of NPR West.